attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today, I've caught Tom Fishburne. Every week, thanks to Tom's satirical skewerings in The Marketoonist, there are around 500,000 business types who are able to laugh at the daft and despairing industry we call marketing. In fact, having grown enormously thanks to word of chuckling mouth, his cartoons are now the brightest spots in the world's most famous business publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and Fast Company. Drawing in both senses from 20 years in the marketing world, Tom also shares his wit and wisdom as the keynotiest of keynote speakers, including an unmissable TED chinwag on the power of laughing at ourselves at work. And as well as poking fun at marketing, he's also done more than his fair share of prodding it towards a more meaningful and mirthful place as the founder of Marketoonist Agency, who had created campaigns for everyone from Google and Microsoft to the Everest of humorlessness, LinkedIn. Tom says we need our sense of humor more than ever in marketing, both as a survival mechanism for marketers working in marketing, but also as a useful tool in marketing communication itself. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Giles. Great to be here.
Right. Seven quickfires, Tom. Number one, pen or pencil?
Ooh, both. Pencil for ideas, pen for the finishing.
Number two, The Simpsons or South Park?
Simpsons.
Easy. Number three, make them laugh or make them cry?
Ooh, make them laugh.
Right, San Francisco one here. The Giants or the 49ers?
I got to say Giants, although I enjoy live events, but I don't follow it on TV at all.
Okay. Number five, subtle sarcasm or obvious irony?
Subtle sarcasm.
Dave Chappelle or Mitch Hedberg?
Ooh, I'm not familiar with Mitch Hedberg. Dave Chappelle.
Oh, Dave Chappelle. Please become familiar with Mitch Hedberg, my favorite comic. Number seven, who is the best marketing Ryan? Ryan Woolman or Ryan Reynolds?
Definitely Ryan Woolman.
Nice. Amazing. Well, listen, Tom, thanks so much again for joining us. We always start the show by asking guests about their path to where they are now. And I have a feeling yours is going to be an interesting one. I think importantly for me, there's so much value in people understanding the journey and the route that people take. So can you start by telling our listeners about your first ever jobs and then your first proper marketing jobs?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been pretty circuitous. It's funny standing at the start of my career, I had no idea where things would twist and turn. And now I look back and there's kind of a reason for every little bump along the journey. I was an English major. I love to write. And initially in college, I thought I might want to go into publishing, magazine publishing, book publishing, something like that. I had no exposure to business at all. On the cartooning side of my life, I always loved cartoons. I loved doodling, but I was too scared to really do anything with it or to share them. I'd never do anything with a student paper in university. So I had this kind of publishing bent, did a bunch of magazine publishing related things in college, and then kind of got a wild hair after university and decided to move to Eastern Europe without knowing anybody. I bought a one-way ticket to Prague a few years after the wall came down and thought initially, well, I had worked this summer job on a dude ranch and I had a little bit of money at the end of that. I thought I'll just go till the money runs out, or maybe I'll see if I can find work and make something happen. And I ended up staying in Prague for a year and finding a job in a small English language magazine, met my future wife there, who is another American living in Prague. And then that kind of set me on the path for working on my writing, but also kind of startup culture, because we were a startup magazine in this funny environment of Prague in the 90s, when we really had to figure out what we were doing on the fly. That led to me getting exposure to advertising, of course, the magazine and brands. Eventually found my way to San Francisco after that in the late 90s and got involved in internet development and continued getting connections with brands, trying to build their first websites and communicate online. So that was really interesting. And I realized I had no business background, so I found myself in business school where, to my surprise, I really got into cartooning. Not a lot of people go to business school to discover they want to be a cartoonist, but that's where I first started drawing cartoons in the student newspaper. And then some of my professors started commissioning me to create cartoons as teaching aids and things like that. And so it's weird. By the time I graduated from business school, I had exposure to marketing and an interest in that. I had exposure to cartooning and an interest in that. My career has really been a combination of those two things. Consumer products marketing, while drawing cartoons on the side. Initially, it was just an email to colleagues, and then people started to sign up for it, and it kind of got its own momentum. And after about 8 years of drawing cartoons on the side and working for a lot of different brands doing consumer marketing, I finally got to the point where I was like, I want to take a jump and see if I can make a go at this full time and build a little creative studio around cartoons and marketing. And I've been doing that for the last 14 years. It gave me a perspective on how we can so often take ourselves too seriously in business, and that there's such a need for it. If you can get the humor right and poke fun at some of the things, it can actually have business value. And years later, I ended up getting invited to Stanford Graduate School of Business to be a part of a course on the power of humor in business, taught by two professors. It's kind of the first like MBA level course on humor in business, and it really brought it full circle for me just to see the potential of it. And then in that course, they were actually teaching students to remember their innate sense of humor when they go into work.
It's really interesting. When I interview people on Call to Action, and we've had, I think you are our 157th guest, I think.
Amazing.
I always hear these stories, and I suppose the caveman brain in me tries to find clues in their early lives that led to cartooning. So humor me just for a moment. Was there anything growing up that particularly interested you, or we can kind of apply some logic to how you ended up doing cartoons? Like, were you particularly into cartoons, either watching or drawing or anything like that, which can show a bit of a path?
Yeah, I was definitely. Gary Larson and The Far Side kind of blew my mind as a kid. And then when I was a teenager, I discovered Matt Groening. Before The Simpsons, he had this great alternative weekly cartoon called Life in Hell. And there was a book of his, School is Hell, about school humor. And I was a surly 14-year-old, and the humor just slayed me. I loved it. And years later, I got a chance to meet Matt Groening, and I brought my copy of School is Hell, and I got him to sign it, which was a real treat.
Oh, that's amazing. So were you into comedy as well? I mean, I suppose the two come hand in hand, right?
They do, but yeah, all forms of comedy, particularly Monty Python as a teenager, really was a big part. The Kids in the Hall, which was a Canadian kind of humor show. I used to record the David Letterman show when I was at school and then watch it after school because it was on at I'd record it, and it was on at like 12:30 at night. So I'd record it, and then the next day I'd come back from school and that was my daily ritual. And he had a lot of comedians on Letterman. So all of those sources kind of definitely got me hooked on different sides of comedy, although I didn't really know much about it, about how it all fit. It just made me laugh.
Yeah. One thing that I think when I'm talking to people who work in that hype of, making people laugh and so on and so forth, is that you need to have lived a life of observations in order to then have material to make observation. So was it soon after your one-way ticket to Prague that you started to observe peculiarities? Or I imagine that must have been quite a shock to the system anyway when you landed the other side of the world.
Yeah, it was a weird first job because I didn't know what proper companies look like. And here we were, Eastern Europe, and it was just hard to get a phone connected. And we all, to put out a magazine, we all shared one Power Mac computer and had around production time, we had a clock around, 24-hour clock, and we all take like a 2-hour shift to come in and lay out the ads and drop in the articles and stuff like that. So it was a little bizarre, but it was fun. And we got through it all with humor, and our magazine had a lot of humor in it. And it was just, I found humor is such a great mechanism to make sense of the world, but it's also kind of a bonding thing when you're with a group of people and you all share the same inside jokes. it kind of, it's a way to get through it. We made some lifelong friends at that stage of life because we all have these same inside jokes from what it was like to live in Prague in the mid-90s when everything was in transition.
Nice. So you said you've been doing it for 14 years as your, you know, proper gig, I suppose, if you like. Do you remember what your first cartoon was that you doodled and shared within the office walls?
Yeah, so then that was even earlier. So yeah, the 14 years was doing it full time. But my first cartoon on the office walls, yeah, I'd done this business school cartoon strip for 2 years and I loved it. And then I found myself at General Mills, this big, you know, large consumer products company, very hierarchical. And I found myself in this environment where all of us starting to work there. It was the same type of thing. We all had these inside jokes about what it was like to make things happen. And so I thought, wow, there's so much humor potential here. And so I think the first cartoon I drew was a little bit of a crib on a Matt Groening setup in that original School as Hell book. He had this series of cartoons where he would do like the 30 types of teachers or the 30 types of student. And he kind of parodied, he'd give them names and parody them. And I did like the 9 types of brand managers. And I drew like characteristics about each one. That was one of the, I think that was within the first 2 or 3 cartoons that I did. I remember that one. And that struck a chord with people. I found with my coworkers, people would print it out and they would write in the names of people they thought matched those different stereotypes. And it left it at my desk. And then it was right around that time I started to get sign-ups from all over the place. And this was all just kind of an email thing. The first time I emailed it out, I just put people on blind CC. And then people would start emailing me from the outside saying, can I get on your list? So I had to learn how to make a kind of an email, like subscription list and set it up from there. But it was those early cartoons that started striking a chord. I realized not only within General Mills, but like the marketing world at large, I suddenly realized there's a much bigger community of people all working in marketing. And we all have the same inside jokes. And we all wanted an outlet to laugh about some of these things.
Did any brand managers see it, I wonder?
Oh yeah, a ton. I mean, and very early on, I wanted to make fun of myself. Like I never had the side of my humor where I was like making fun at somebody else in a poison pen kind of way. Like my material can be pretty satirical, and I like. And there's obviously a butt of the joke, but if there's a butt of the joke, it's usually me in some way, shape, or form. And so definitely I fell into a few of those stereotypes within those types of brand managers. And I like that. I like it when you can laugh with each other about ourselves. You know, it's an affiliative type of humor that naturally connects with my natural humor, I guess. And so I was absolutely making fun of myself at all that too.
Yeah, I mentioned to you before we started recording that I've just been with Ryan in Australia, and obviously the work that we did for Delusions of Brandure and How Brands Blow, I think is a very fine line that you tread sometimes. To be clear that you're laughing at yourself, I think is quite important.
100%. Yes. Yeah. I think, well, particularly in marketing, because like you said at the start, we can take ourselves a bit too seriously. The reality is things are, they change so quickly. And so no one's as much of an expert as they sometimes portray. And I think it's really healthy to highlight how it's always a work in progress. Because when we can laugh at ourselves, we can really kind of hold up, you know, what's not working. You know, there are a lot of cases in marketing where the emperor has no clothes. And sometimes we're afraid to kind of point that out. And I found, you know, early on at General Mills, I joined the company because I worked in only scrappy startups. And so the idea of being in a big company that really knew what it was doing appealed to me. But then I found myself there and there was so much entrenched, embedded knowledge that was a little bit oftentimes we acted like we had, like it was more scientific than it was. And so I thought it was fun, but also important to highlight the things that weren't going well so we could actually talk about them and move forward and like do things a little bit differently.
Yeah. Was it very much separate to your work at General Mills? Was there any time where there was an overlap with humor? Like, did humor have a place aside from this, like little side hustle that you had in the work that you were doing day to day at General Mills?
Yeah, it started to bubble up in funny places. Like at first, my friend thought I was going to get fired for it. And then the CMO at General Mills called me into his office. I thought he was going to yell at me, but instead he was like, I love what you're doing. I love that you're finding humor in what we do, because it's a useful cultural thing for us to be able to do that. And then he was encouraging, there were a few other creative outlets. There was like an improv show that the brand managers all did and things like that, that I thought were really healthy and productive. And it started to seep it in a little bit into how I did my work. I started early on when we would talk about personas or target consumers, I would actually like hand draw like a cartoon caricature of different consumer archetypes and put some funny details in there. alongside my slide decks to the extended company. And I found that those started circulating more widely than some of our regular slides. So it started to seep through in that way. And, you know, the brands I worked on were pretty tightly contained, and we had so many different tiers of groups working on them, including outside agencies, that, you know, humor wasn't a big part of the equation on how we marketed, at least on the brands that I worked on. They popped up somehow, but it was more of just more of a kind of a smile type of humor than something that was really funny. It wasn't until I found myself with a smaller challenger brand years later called Method that was, you know, going into the category of household cleaning. And it had a real irreverent kind of almost like the court jester type of archetype in its role in the category, where we just make fun of category norms. That's the first time that humor really, I was really part of things where humor started to pervade the marketing itself. And actually, when I first arrived in England, I was helping bring the Method brand to the UK. I was trying to, like, I always had a big appreciation for British humor, and I was trying to think how some things could translate or we could play with different things. And I came across something I'd never heard of before called gurning, which is, I guess there's some competition in Northern England or maybe Scotland where you make crazy faces and there's a gurning competition. And we'd had an advertisement that showed some kids in a bathtub. The headline was, "You may not know what your tiles taste like, but your kids do." And the whole thing was about, like, you know, if you're cleaning with toxic chemicals, it leaves residues and things like that. We ended up getting this idea for an event in London that we were a part of. And we made a giant version of that ad, but we cut out the holes for the faces. And then we had a gurning competition. So everyone came up and they made these crazy faces where the kids' faces should be. And then we gave them all, like, printouts of their faces, but also had an award for the craziest face. And it was a moment where we kind of tapped into this collective humor. It became a very popular booth for people to come by and make these crazy faces. So that's one area where it started to pop up, where I started to feel comfortable as, you know, using humor as communication itself, not just as a way, as a survival mechanism to get through the day-to-day job of marketing.
It's nice to know that you spent time in England, in Richmond, you were saying earlier. Can England take any credit for the for your humor? I mean, you've already mentioned Monty Python, who, you know, I think I'd struggle to better Monty Python as a comic reference.
It's an amazing comic reference. So I've always loved British humor, but living there, I got a much deeper appreciation, particularly from my British colleagues, who you know, very quickly introduced me to Viz magazine and very irreverent stuff, and all the way through to, you know, Fawlty Towers, things I just hadn't had an exposure to. If anything, it gave me an appreciation for dry humor in a different way than what I'd grown up with in the States. And occasionally I hear from people who think I'm British, even though my spelling is obviously American. And I always take that as a huge compliment, because I've been a big fan of British humor for a long time.
Yeah. Amazing. And where did you find, if at all, you found most of your material?
I found it helpful in my life generally to always have a sketchbook around, because I found my ideas would come in unexpected places for my work, but also in the margin, somebody would say something in a meeting and I would think, oh, that's a good cartoon. That's an interesting, what was just said in that meeting is representative. And I bet a lot of people are feeling that same way. So I developed this habit of being kind of a collector of things that I would hear and see and save them to, like, digest and focus on later. So that's always been a big part of it for me. But early on, people would send me crazy stories of things that would happen in their offices too. And I love that. I started getting a lot of material that way. My output has to be so much higher because I work with so many brands creating campaigns with humor and cartoons. So I have more of a process to come up with cartoons now. And there's, like, a whole research stage that makes sure I have the right stimulus to draw from. But my favorite types of moments are when I'm sort of sitting somewhere and something crosses my path and I observe something funny and think, oh my gosh, if I could just take this moment and expand it and simplify it, it might represent something that we can all laugh at.
Time, weather, and always. We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine.
firstly, I love your work, and it won't, you know, surprise you to know that. I'm sure you knew that before we started recording. But the if I just think about some of the cartoons that I, the my go-to cartoons for when your name comes up, the Internet of Things, for example, your cartoons are wonderful, but they're also a commentary on the industry. And sometimes in commentating on the industry, you can touch on things where there's quite a lot of moral dilemma, I suppose, for want of a better word. And in that cartoon, if you know, if listeners aren't familiar with it, the annotation is, "I think my Nest smoke alarm is going off. Google AdWords just pitched me a fire extinguisher and an offer for temporary housing." It's brilliant, but like underneath it all, there is a serious conversation there to be had, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I feel like I try to keep abreast of all the changes in marketing and think about what should we be talking more about? And oftentimes I aim in that direction. I want it to be funny. I think it can sometimes get too little boring if it feels like a sermon on an issue. So it's a delicate balance. I want to be able to laugh at something we're all observing, but also have it have a bit of a point so we can have it as a conversation starter. That one was an interesting cartoon to draw because it was early in the conversation about the Internet of Things. And I published it maybe a week or two before the whole Davos gathering, and that ended up being a big topic for that year's Davos. And Tim Berners-Lee, you know, one of the inventor of the internet, he shared it like at Davos, and it got a lot of traction. So that was one of those moments where, you know, usually the cartoons I draw are just part of the marketing community. You know, it's kind of an insular group, and you know, many people might not understand the root of the humor. But that was a moment where it was suddenly hitting a larger cultural topic. And so I got a lot of feedback and attention on that cartoon from a wider audience. And I think it helped spark conversations because people were sensing this is something we needed to talking about more, like where the data is, how it's all connecting. And this, and I feel like it illustrated one way that humor can help make the medicine go down or synthesize a point in a way that's easily digestible and shareable. You know, I've always loved the medium of cartoons. It's like the simplest form of storytelling. It's this simple little snapshot of an idea that can be widely shared. And that was a moment where it was something people were talking about and suddenly they could have something easy to share to get the conversation going.
Yeah. I remember when Bob Hoffman was on a few years ago and we were talking around similar topics in terms of social media. So, you know, that sort of social listening side of things and everything from ad fraud and programmatic ad systems. And I think Bob made the point that increasingly the tools that we use within marketing represent a threat to democracy. So, I mean, it's amazing, but not surprising to hear that cartoon in particular got shared so widely. But I suppose without necessarily even wanting to, these things are very relevant outside of our industry.
They are. Partly with humor and partly with cartoons specifically, is like the audience helps put it all together. Like the visual only contains so much information, but it's the viewer who sees it and they bring their own experience to bear on it that gives it the bigger unlock. So I found it really interesting to see how people would have used my cartoons over the years, but even that one specifically to like go in a bunch of different directions beyond what I was ever thinking about at the moment. I'm thinking about only one little part and they take it in a bunch of different directions. And I think it's really interesting for me. I love the idea exchange part of that. And I always try to come at it with an open mind and learn from a lot of different people and always recognize like things that are so new and emerging. Nobody really knows how it's going to play out, but it's good to have a conversation.
Yeah. Do you think any brand can and potentially should embrace humor?
I do. I think pretty much any brand can embrace it to some degree, but there are different flavors of humor and types of humor, and not every type of humor is right for every brand. I kind of think humor, you know, it's internal characteristics when you're building a culture. And I feel like humor internally can set an incredible tone to, you know, particularly set from the top that it's okay to laugh at ourselves. And through some of my keynote speaking work, I spend a lot of time with organizations to get a sense of what different cultures are like. And I think, you know, no matter what you're working on, there's a role for humor to kind of help people talk openly about what's really going on. In the external communication, I think it's the flavor of humor. I think one thing I've discovered now in working with kind of over 200 different brands on types of cartoon campaigns, some of the industries are really serious. And I've worked with a lot of law firms, for instance, or HR firms or companies where there are a lot of sensitivities about what you can and can't make fun of. But inevitably, if you keep it focused on what the audience is already laughing about in the industry, and if you're able to tap into some of that, it kind of puts the brand in a nice position to be laughing with the audience. And that's a really desirable characteristic. My entry point is often some type of a pain point that the audience is already experiencing and recognizing. And every industry has pain points. And if a brand can find the right way to kind of laugh with the audience about some of those pain points, I can't think of an industry where that's not relevant or something to shy away from, you know. But given what I said, having some guardrails around maybe the types of things that are inbounds and out of bounds. Not every type of comedy is like the shock jock, you know, aggressive type of humor. And I think a lot of brands shy away from the whole idea of humor because they immediately think, oh my gosh, we don't want to get caught into that type of humor. But there's a lot, it's a really wide area. Humor is this innately human thing that we all have. And if you approach it in the right way, there's a flavor of humor that's appropriate to every brand, I think.
Yeah, well said. I think it's very easy to just think or assume there's topics where you shouldn't consider humor. But I just add some context. Earlier today, I actually shared on a LinkedIn, it was an old Volvo ad that AMV did in the late 1980s. It was part of the decade-long efforts of Volvo to become synonymous with safety. I think the headline was "Cages Save Lives," and the image was Sylvester the cat with Tweety Pie in his cage. And so, of course, it was immediately, from an art direction perspective, it's really humorous, but it pulls you in. It makes a very important comment about the association with Volvo basically being a cage on wheels. But then it tackles in the body copy something as serious as road and car safety. To me, that was such a great example of how you're using something quite irreverent as a way into talking about something really serious. And I think it's really refreshing to kind of share those types of examples because it's too easy, perhaps, for brands to just assume that humor has no role to play.
100%. Oh, I love that example. Yeah, where this really came to kind of vivid reality for me was at the start of COVID, when every brand was shocked into, oh, this is not a time for humor. And you know, the thing I kept hearing over and over again is better too serious than sorry. And we have longtime clients who paused work or decided we're going to go in a different direction. And I totally understand what was going on at the time. But the result was that every bit of marketing in the early part of the pandemic kind of sounded alike. And people actually were looking for outlets to laugh a little bit. And some of the early brands that were able to find a bit of humor, it ended up allowing them to stand for something a little bit different. Some brands that were starting to do it, even having early COVID regulations about how far people should stand away from each other. I remember New Jersey did this whole campaign about, they were referencing kind of New Jersey reference points, like how many Bruce Springsteens you have to stand away from other people. It took something that could be very dry, and we were surrounded by all this very dry, serious messaging, and put a little bit of humanity around it. And I think actually helped the messaging go down. I mean, obviously the in-flight video changes in the last 20 years have been an example of this. Almost to a degree, it can be a little bit of annoying now because every brand does it. But at the start, the idea that you would take something like that and add some humor to it, it actually makes people pay attention to the messaging even more. And that's the core lesson, I think, that a lot of brands can pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the 200-odd brands that you work with. How varying are they?
Oh, really varied. I'd say maybe two-thirds of the campaigns have been external B2B marketing. So I do have a bent on B2B marketing. Like being a business person myself, I kind of focus on business humor. So the audiences are connected with that. There's a big tranche of campaigns that have been for internal audiences, like HR communication, you know, humor to convey different brand values or, you know, some type of an internal transformation. But the industries are really broad. I mean, everything from industries I never even knew existed, like e-discovery, which is a whole field where law firms exchange information when they're suing each other. It used to be all paper-based and now it's all digital, of course, but that means that lawyers have to be a little more tech savvy. That's a whole industry around e-discovery. And I worked on a weekly cartoon for over 5 years in e-discovery. And people still contact me thinking I know, you know, I'm some e-discovery expert. And I learned it all purely by working in the industry on the side. But it helped me appreciate that even in this subculture, there's humor. And if you can tap into it, it's really a fun place to be. They brought me in actually for a trade show to sign cartoon calendars, and it blew my mind how many people were there, how many people like understood all the inside jokes that I was learning on this learning curve to learn about what they could make fun of. But that if you tap into it, it can be really, really effective.
Yeah, I don't know whether to find it reassuring that it's not just marketing that we can really, you know, there's plenty of material to laugh at, or depressing.
I find it like exciting. Like, I feel like it would be, it'd be a shame to work in a job that was never changing. I like the constant change and that it's a bit of progress, not perfection. Like, we're not going to be perfect. And so making fun of what's not working so that we can keep moving forward. I really like that. It keeps things interesting and exciting. And like you said at the start, too often we take ourselves too seriously, particularly in stuffy doll industries.
Yeah, for sure. Is the consistency just the fact that people are people and we're all daft and have the same kind of quirks and weird responses to things, rather than it being just marketing and business?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, humor is innately human. I was part of that Stanford course on the power of humor. The first exercise that the professors gave the students was simply to take an email that the students had written in the previous week or two, and then read it with fresh eyes and to see how, like, in some ways inhuman it was, like writing like a robot or using buzzwords or being overly formal. And then the assignment was just simply to write it more like a human. And people took a moment, they added bits of humor, and it completely changed it. And I feel like, particularly in business, we often come at it from the standpoint that we need to make it so professional that it strips out too much of the humanness. And so when you can get past that, it can really create some good cut through.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I warned you that we've got quite a few listener questions, so I might go there now and then I can probably get them all in.
Fantastic.
So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger, but that's not stopped us asking. I'm going to drop the client I mentioned earlier because his name should ring a bell. So Brian McCready, who's been one of our main clients for a few years at Addleshaw Goddard, he's actually said, he's preceded his question with, "I adore Tom Fishburne. We did a campaign with him on employment law and AI law. Love his work, output, approach, manner, creativity, everything. Honestly, he is a gentleman, a genius, and a creative treasure." And I haven't just made that up. And that's Brian, if you're listening, you've never said anything like that about me on the record.
That's amazing. Thank you, Brian. That really means a lot.
Brian then says, of all the buffoonery, jargon, and nonsense from the marketing profession that he has featured in his cartoons, which was the topic or issue where he thought this industry has lost its way a little?
Wow, such a great, the whole topic is kind of an evergreen thing, to be honest. I feel like every few years there's some new material. The whole idea of digital transformation might be one of those long-running areas, just because it's used so widely, particularly when it was kind of early in its introduction, and yet there was no idea what was actually meant by it. There was sort of an idea, but people meant different things. And a lot of the insight into how people would use it was if it was just a one and done thing, like, oh, we just need to transform and then we'll be done, rather than this ongoing transformation. So I found endless things to make fun of in that whole, that, you know, using the terminology around digital transformation because of that disconnect between what people thought it meant and how it was so often brought up. But, you know, obviously it continues to this day, and it's shifted into AI transformation. That AI is, I'm finding echoing of similar effects. But this is an ongoing thing. I remember I just came across a cartoon I drew 11 years ago on big data, and had a bunch of people around a conference table and somebody saying, you know, let's solve this problem by using the big data. None of us have any idea what it means or how to use something along those lines. I feel like that comes up, particularly in the marketing community, where there's new terminology. Suddenly it's a bandwagon effect and there's not a lot of understanding on how it could best be used. For our particular brand needs, it sometimes gets ahead of the strategy, and you miss the big picture, which is that ultimately it's not about the technology, it's how we use the technology to advance whatever strategy we're trying to pursue. So that's an evergreen topic for me to make fun of.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, aren't there? But digital transformation is just one of those examples where something could mean anything, so it means nothing. Another question from our good mate, Ryan Woolman. Ryan asks, satirical humor can be a fine line sometimes, especially when the audience might see themselves in it. You seem to tread that line perfectly, but do you ever second guess yourself if the topic is contentious or feels like it goes against industry groupthink?
I do think about that a lot. And it's hard. It's so hard with humor because I can see something I drew 1 hour, and the next hour I look at it and see it a little bit differently. Sometimes I draw a cartoon, I feel really good about it, and I wake up nervous in the middle of the night before it's scheduled to go out, thinking, oh my gosh, are people going to take this in a way I didn't intend? I do think about that a lot. I guess my litmus test is that if I ever feel like I'm really laughing at another's expense, like if it ever shifts from I'm laughing at myself, even if I haven't been in that situation, I can see myself being in the position of that cartoon character who represents, you know, saying something, you know, whatever. I always want to connect with the butt of the joke. And if I ever like, I'm not the butt of the joke, I'm actually the butt of the joke is something else. And there's like a line of like meanness that I occasionally I've bumped up against. And I always kind of wince a little bit. It might make me laugh, but I'm like, it's a little too barbed. That whenever I feel that feeling, I try to move away from it. So that's usually my internal litmus test on that. And thankfully, I run every cartoon sketch past my wife because she can see it with fresh eyes and is great at giving me feedback.
Yeah, where do you stand on that? I don't want to trip you up here, but where do you stand on the people taking things in a way that wasn't intended? Because you've got, I mean, quite recently, the likes of Ricky Gervais has come out and said things like, well, that joke's obviously not for you then. And I think even more frequently, Stephen Fry came out and was quite, defensive, I think quite rightly, of people who might offend without intent. It's quite a tricky thing to discuss.
Yeah, it can be. I try not to think about the reaction to the cartoons beyond those initial like thresholds. I just want to make sure it's kind of in the zone of something I feel good about. Like if it makes me laugh in a good way and not like I'm wincing because maybe I'm pushing. So it's really my own internal barometer. If I start to think about how everybody might perceive every potential part of the humor, I ultimately would just stop creating because it would just be overwhelming. So I try not to do that. I don't do very much social listening of my cartoons after I've published them because of that. I love that people take it in different ways and directions generally, and I find it entertaining. I remember I drew one cartoon about greenwashing, and I got two licensing requests the next week. One was from some business consulting firm, and the other was from the American Communist Party. And I was like, wow, you could not get two audience further afield. And they both found something funny in this cartoon. And it made me laugh a bit that that happened, but also made me feel like I lose control of it once it's out there. And so I try to make sure I'm aiming in a way that's consistent with my type of humor, ultimately. And beyond that, the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, well said. We've had a question from a listener called Lucy. Lucy says, what do you think of Can adding a humor category? Doesn't it suggest humor doesn't belong in other categories?
I think it's great to have attention to humor. The fact that it actually is not just a frivolous thing, but actually has some business value. I mean, there's quite a lot of research around this now on how humor creates cut through and memorability and communication. Like I think it's great that there's more focus on humor as something that should be part of the toolkit. So I definitely support that. I found it a little confusing at Con to see exactly where humor showed up because I couldn't quite tell exactly how they were treating it as a separate category. There's no place that I could go to see work that sort of fell under that veil. And in some ways I was encouraged because I agree humor can be a part of everything. Like it's just part of the toolkit, like every other type of way that marketing communication works. But I like having examples like the one you shared earlier about Volvo and the Tweety Bird. I would love for that example to be widely known in the marketing community because it overcomes some of the preconceptions people might have that humor is not a serious way to communicate. Overall, I like the move, but I don't really know how it plays out at Con because I didn't really see it.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes complete sense. And I think articulation that it's part of the toolkit is important, but then I suppose I would take that and suggest because I feel the same way I believe Lucy does by the way she's phrased her question that for the same reason you wouldn't have a category of I don't know sadness or any other kind of emotive reaction. I don't see why humor has to be kind of compartmentalized. Lastly, I'm going to squeeze the fourth one in. Actually, I think we've got time. Elliot asks, will AI ever be funnier than your favorite stand-up comedian?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think about that a lot. I had a chance to have a lunch years ago with the cartoon editor at the New Yorker at the time, Bob Mankoff. It's since transitioned to a new editor, Emma. But we talked a lot about AI, even at that point, I think it was like 2017. he was starting to work with AI startups trying to create humor. And at that point, it was very absurdist what would come back from AI. Now it's I'd say it seems much more like it's actually like an attempt at a joke. And I have seen some moments of humor that make me smile, not quite laugh, but I find that most of the threshold that keep it from being funnier are human-made thresholds. I feel like with each successive iteration of the popular large language models, some of the thresholds that are built into it have actually wrapped it in so much bubble wrap and it's taken it away from being funnier. I think there's so much sensitivity to it being taken the wrong way. I feel like it would have to take unwrapping some of the bubble wrap to get to a place where it is funnier. But I find that because humor relies so much on surprise, and because the way LLMs work is synthesizing what's been done before, the out-of-the-box output of LLMs tend to be a kind of a great averaging, which doesn't have as much of the surprise elements. So I feel like the potential is there, but there needs to be more opportunity to tinker around the edges so that there's less bubble wrap and so that it can have more surprise elements. I feel like humor is innately human. And as we try to make AI sound increasingly human, we're losing something there. And so as I look, you know, personally at the opportunities, I find it can be useful at synthesizing things. Like I occasionally take briefs that I write for myself, and I use AI to experiment with ways to make the briefs better. But when it comes to the spark of creating actual jokes and humor, there's part of what I love about it that I don't want to let go of. It's kind of like the old thing I've seen written that we wanted to create AI to help us do the laundry and the dishes so that we have more time being creative and writing. And instead it's writing and being creative and giving us more time to do the laundry and wash the dishes. And I feel like because my style of humor is something I like to do, I've steered my entire career to do more of what I like to do in humor and at the drafting table. You know, I selfishly don't want to give that part up. And I actually think there's real value in that. And so I wonder with stand-up comics, I've definitely seen outputs from LLMs and I wonder, you know, obviously the direction is going in a certain way, but I feel like most of the output has been more of an averaging than creating something that feels the type of humor that makes me laugh.
Yeah, well said. I think the, who knows where it will go in, you know, in 10 years time, wherever it could be, far beyond anything we can possibly conceive or perceive. But there's that lovely quote from E.B. White of explaining a joke is like dissecting a frog. You understand it better, but the frog dies in the process. And I think any kind of AI humor that I've seen so far is just delivering lots of dead frogs.
And this the saddest I probably saw was someone brought back Carlin. They put in all of Carlin's jokes and created a fake stand-up bit of Carlin. And there were things kind of in the vein. I could see why it was said to be like a stand-up, but it was clearly an averaging of what had been done before. There was nothing, no new spark there which would have come from his comedic mind. There's a lot of individual personality in humor. Who knows? I'm really curious to see where this goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. You fielded all of those brilliantly. So the final part of the interview then, Tom, is our four pertinent poses, starting with what advice would you give to your younger self?
Not to let moments of fear or anxiety get in the way of doing, of taking more chances. And I feel like the greatest breakthroughs in my own career was when I took a wild gamble on something, you know, flying to Prague, you know, leaving my job to be a cartoonist. Those types of things. And I'm glad that I did. There were other moments where I feel like I played it safe. And you always wonder what would have been in those moments. So I encourage my own adult children. And I think about myself. Those moments of taking risk is less risky than you might think.
Yeah. Nice. Well said. Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
The level of taking ourselves too seriously that involves acting like we have more expertise than we really do. There's a lot of pontificating that comes across as if it's, you know, written from on high, when in reality, we're all just trying to figure it out. I like it better when people are open about, hey, we're not sure where this is headed. We're experimenting, we're playing with it. Here's some of my own mistakes and foibles, and we can celebrate some of the failures. versus those that act like they have the answer.
Yeah. Nice. Very nice. And number three, are there any books that you would recommend apart from your ad ignored here, cartoons from 15 years of marketing, business and doodlings in meetings, which we've linked to in this episode?
There's a great book called Orbiting the Giant Hairball that was written from the perspective of a former creative director at Hallmark, who had a lot of creativity in his work, but found himself working in a very hierarchical bureaucratic company. And he finding some of the ways that he found to navigate that without sacrificing too much of what was true to himself, I think is great reading for anybody trying to be a bit iconoclastic in their own company.
As you can imagine, after 157 episodes of asking that question, it's becoming increasingly rare to have a book that hasn't come up before. But I can say with some confidence that Orbiting the Giant Hairball has not come up before. Fantastic. You also mentioned School is Hell earlier. Is that still available? Are you aware?
That's a good question. I'm sure it's available on eBay, if not readily in wild circulation. He had a whole series along those lines, Love is Hell, Work is Hell. He had a weekly cartoon strip in a lot of alternative papers. He's a great inspiration for, I think, modern day cartoonists and how you're not bound by the way the industry looks today. You can find new avenues for your works. You know, when his cartoons were so subversive, you couldn't imagine them being the regular daily papers. So he started being in an alternative paper, and then he actually built his own syndication company to syndicate his own work to alternative papers, which were very independent and all over the world. And he brought on other cartoonists as part of his syndication. And that was all before, you know, The Simpsons came along and made him a household name. And so his work is just, it was genius. It was a shame that he stopped drawing his regular cartoons. He kept that going for a long time, even through his fame with The Simpsons. It was just, I heard him describe it once as his foundation. He would keep the cartoon going as like, almost like his creative exercise. And it was really absurd and subversive humor on everything. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Nice. Well, I'll look that up and try to link to that as well then, because I'm certainly going to try and dig it out. Sounds fantastic. And then number four, Tom, is we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow that honor to our guest who has to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
Oh, brilliant. I think I might dedicate it to David Hyatt, David and Claire Hyatt, who are a married couple in Wales who started Howie's and the Do Lectures and now Hyatt Denim. In some ways, I owe it to them that I ended up taking this left turn and making cartooning transition from a hobby into my work, because I went to one of the Do Lectures and at one point they asked, what do you want to do with your life? And we all had to write it on a little card. And I wrote, I want to be a cartoonist when I grow up. And so it inspired me to head in that direction. And a year after making the jump to do it full time, they invited me to come back to the Do Lectures and tell that story. And so while I don't know David and Claire personally all that well, they've had a tremendous influence on my life and choices, and continue to inspire so many other people to listen to what their inner voice is telling them and to take chances with their careers and their lives. And I really admire what they do.
Amazing. Well, that's a fantastic dedication. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to both Claire and David Hyatt. And I'm incredibly jealous that you've been to one of the Do Lectures, Tom. I have I've tried to attend previously, so far unsuccessfully.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah. No, David, an inspiration. Everything he touched, and he's also, I believe, another Welshman. So I'm particularly fond of him for that reason. But amazing. So as a final call to action, everyone listening can find links to everything we've discussed, including Orbiting the Giant Hairball. We'll try and dig out some of the cartoons that we spoke on, whether that's, you know, Life is Hell, School is Hell, etc. How else can our listeners get more Tom Fishburne?
I send out a weekly newsletter, which I've been doing now for over 22 years, every Monday morning, and you can subscribe at marketoonist.com. I also write 300 to 500 words on each cartoon to kind of unpack the topic a little bit more. And so that's really like, it's almost been my personal diary over my own career, but in a way, a friend of mine described it as like a diary for marketing over the last, you know, however long, I've, you know, 22 years. There's so many twists and turns. And so that's the best way to stay in contact with me. We're definitely at an interesting stage in marketing and business in general. So there'll no shortage of cartoon material to come.
Amazing. Amazing. Have you got any talks coming up that you can plug?
I do. I'm doing a virtual talk with Marketing Academy in February.
Amazing. So listen, all that's left for me to, is to say thank you for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to talk, Tom.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. It's great chatting, and I've been an admirer of your work for a long time.
Thank you, Tom. And thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. But I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.